The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today we will dig into the main theme of the May issue of Our State Magazine, A State of Beauty and Grace. We see it all around us, in the gentle curve of a swan's neck, the delicate flutter of a butterfly's wings. We hear it in the soft melodies of a harp, the rush of a waterfall. Sometimes we can even taste it in the fleeting, subtle sweetness of a honeysuckle flower. In North Carolina, that intangible quality becomes tangible, infusing our everyday lives with wonder. And the picture on this page is of a tundra swan that's gliding across Lake Matamuskeet on the Albemarle-Pamlico Peninsula, where thousands of birds rest their wings after their journey south each winter. The first article is entitled, A Taste of Honey. Remember plucking honeysuckle blossoms off the vine for that single drop of nectar? Every spring, diners clamored for a Chapel Hill restaurant's honeysuckle sorbet, nearly as fleeting as the real thing, and every bit as sweet. The perfume was fleeting, but overwhelming. The parking lot at Crook's Corner, the Chapel Hill restaurant where I was a chef, had an enormous amount of honeysuckle growing beside it. And starting in late April or early May, its scent traveled on the breeze to our kitchen door. We've all tasted that one drop of nectar in the throat of each flower, and it would occasionally cross my mind to try and capture that flavor in food somehow. The result tends to silence people at first taste. It took a while to figure out what to make with the honeysuckle, and I learned a few things. Lesson number one, don't try to cook it. Lesson number two, don't keep it around forever. The flavor fades. Lesson number three, write down what you did last time because although you think you're going to remember, you won't. In other words, the route to honeysuckle sorbet was long and circuitous. It wound through the Italian novel The Leopard to the writings on Sicily of Mary Taylor Cimetti, who dropped the hint of infusing flowers in cool water. Then, like I said, I had to remember to write down what I'd done last time. My experimental batches were all small because I expected failure, and it's a lot of trouble to pick all those flowers for nothing. Thus, the first successful honeysuckle sorbet didn't last long. It never made it to the dining room, in fact. Word spread fast the first year that sorbet was on the menu. People would line up at the door before we opened because it became known that sometimes we ran out. We had to make a rule that at supper time, those who only wanted sorbet had to sit at the bar because we needed the tables for those who were there for dinner. When we did run out, there could be tantrums. Customers began to order the sorbet as a first course because I had to quit letting them reserve it for after their dinner. Eventually, I figured out mass production, and except for one year when for some reason there were scarcely any flowers, we almost always had enough. During that one lean year, we sometimes didn't even put the sorbet on the menu. We would just sneak it out to regulars with the warning that they couldn't act like anything was up. The reason that we usually had plenty was that I had shown my kitchen staff how to correctly pick the flowers. No leaves, no stems, and I paid them $15 for every 8 cups that they brought in. My cooks would take their children to the parks, and while the little ones played, their parents would gather the flowers that often festooned the fences. People associate honeysuckle perfume with hot summer evenings, but in truth, around here, it begins blooming in the middle of spring. This means that the flowers show up in time for Mother's Day weekend, and in the triangle, graduation season. In the restaurant world, this is a time when complications are least welcome. Too bad. Everyone wants their mother to have some sorbet. You need the flowers to be blooming in full swing to make harvesting them worthwhile. But the minute anyone in town saw a single blossom, I began to get the phone calls. It may have been a bit hectic, but in fact the fuss was quite flattering. I always gave the recipe out freely, and I can't tell you how many times people have told me that once a year they take their children out to pick honeysuckle flowers. It's a family occasion. One woman told me that she and her grandchildren make a batch every May. She liked the recipe because it taught the kids that sometimes you have no choice but to wait for the good things in life. And they have a picture at the very beginning, of course, of the sorbet with honeysuckle sticking out the top. And it says, Bill Smith's honeysuckle sorbet was inspired by a vine that grew near Crook's Corner, the restaurant where he was chef for decades. Now he picks the flowers at home in Chapel Hill. The next article is entitled The Rhythm of the Line. The art of calligraphy dates back to the ancient Romans. Today, would-be artists with quills in hand, continue the tradition of creating letter forms, mastering the strokes in much the same way that people did centuries ago, with lots of practice. At a visual arts school in Winston-Salem, calligraphy students learn more than just how to form letters. They discover the music of the handwritten word. Joyce Tedda still has the calligraphy pen that changed her life. She was 11, and her father's deployment to England had landed her at a London boarding school. Like most American students, Tedda was used to writing with an ordinary pencil or a ballpoint pen. But these instructors made students use a broad-edged pen that they had to dip into an inkwell. It was very uncomfortable, Tedda says, but unlike adults who struggle with their patterns, kids can go, oh, okay, when they're thrown into an unfamiliar situation. They learn how to come out of it. Tedda emerged with an appreciation of letter forms that, since 1977, she's passed along to generations of students at Winston-Salem's Arts and Crafts Workshop, now the Sawtooth School for Visual Art. Unlike Tedda's own boarding school experience, her intro to calligraphy students start off with a familiar tool, slightly altered. Handing each student two pencils taped together with gauze, Tedda demonstrates how to place the pencil points onto a sheet of notebook paper, slowly sliding her arm down to form two parallel lines. When connected, those two points mimic the flat edge of a calligraphy pen. Just feel it, she encourages, peering over her students' shoulders as they struggle to keep both points on the paper at the proper 45-degree angle. It's in you. You just have to find it. It doesn't take long for Tedda's students to get the hang of it, and as their notebook papers fill up with their first calligraphy strokes, Tedda shows them a photo of Trajan's column that she took while visiting Rome. Here's the thing that brings me to tears, she says, pointing to the capital letters chiseled into the base of the column, which was completed in the 2nd century. These letters are magnificent. You don't even need to be close to them to recognize the elegance of their shape. We haven't made them any better in the past 20 centuries. The way Tedda sees it, the ability to form markings is an intuitive sense. We're all born artists, she believes, but most of us don't trust that ability because we don't develop it. When you look at any calligraphied italic letters, you see that there are only 3 strokes, she says. If you understand the stroke sequence, you can build on that. That's just how simple it is to learn. Just as a museum can look at a sheet of music and quickly detect the dominant beats, Tedda can glance at a row of calligraphy letters and see the weighted strokes. That's the first stroke, she says. Her sawtooth students have already mastered it even before they hold a calligraphy pen. Maybe the ancient scribes could have stopped with that weighted stroke. Their paintbrushes and quills could have formed the letters made entirely of thick markings, lacking in width variation. But they didn't. You wouldn't want to hear a song with the same beat over and over again, Teta says. That would be boring and repetitive. The scribes recognized that too, and they adjusted the weight of their markings. Delicate branches connect one weighted stroke to the next, creating a sense of movement that helps a reader's eye glide from left to right. The second stroke moves from top to bottom, and the third is a push-pull stroke. Those are strokes 2 and 3, Teta says. It's as easy as that. The letters formed by those three markings are rich in harmony and proportion. It's extremely intimate to make a mark and then repeat it, she says. It has a beautiful response. It's like getting to know a child. After a week of practice at home, just 10 minutes a day, Teta says, her students understand calligraphy's basic strokes. They dip their pens into small wells of ink and experiment with the word minimum. Teta reminds them to breathe. She can tell if they're breathing by how consistent the spacing is between their letters, noting that the scribe's inhale and exhale are reflected in the white space that invites rest. It doesn't matter which is the inhale or exhale, stroke or space. What matters is the exquisite rhythm in each individual. For many students of form, like Teta, the practice of forming letters is akin to meditation. To me, writing and calligraphy is like yoga, she says. When you're in breath, it feels divine. That's one reason she volunteers to write name tags at Sawtooth's holiday parties. Teta marvels at the sense of pride that people feel when they're given their calligraphy name, handwritten in ink, just for them. As she strokes to form letters, Teta feels connected to the ancient scribes whose marks are still revered. In the same moment, she feels fully present. If I'm writing your name, I'm here, she says, tapping the page in front of her. I think that is so powerful. Sawtooth School for Visual Art was named to the National Register of Historic Places in 1978. Winston-Salem's iconic Sawtooth Building was built in 1911 as Haynes Hosiery's first factory. Today's artists are aided by the sunlight that streams through the jagged roofline of the skylights, just as factory workers were before the widespread use of electric lights. Teta is proud when her students write their first words and begin to fill their notebooks with calligraphy. And it shows a picture of just some rudimentary, an elementary, if you will, calligraphy writings. For more information about the Sawtooth School for Visual Art, visit sawtooth.org. The next one is called Beauty in Plain Sight. In a state blessed with majestic mountains and a sun-kissed coast, a writer discovers that the charm of the coastal plain is there for those who know where to look. Some claim that the coastal plain begins east of I-95, but for those of us who grew up there, the boundary is less clear. You might say there's no physical demarcation, only an emotional one. Landscape exists as much within us as without, so the sight of flat fields curving slightly toward a line of pine forest can trigger an emotional reaction that is just as valid as what passes outside the windshield in letting you know that you're home. My own emotional reaction to that hard-to-pinpoint boundary is much clearer now that I have not lived down there for more than 45 years. Now the landscape is vivid because it's visible, and it's visible because I derive pleasure from its charms. I cannot say the same for the years I spent there when I hardly saw it at all. Or rather, I saw enough of it to know it was not, to my mind, the most beautiful part of our state. It felt insignificant compared to the rolling hills of the Piedmont and the salt marshes of the coast, and of course the majestic wall calendar worthy vistas of the Blue Ridge. What I saw was sandy soil and pine forests, neither of which compared to the attributes of the other three regions of the state. I saw row after row of head-high corn and waist-high tobacco, fields of sprawling beans, peppers, and watermelon. And because I was not of farming stock, I did not look at those fields and see money. I saw monotony. The land felt scrubby, the woods patchy. The fallow fields awaiting the spring disking appeared bereft. I dreamed more of elevation than an anthill. Monotony, however, wasn't only to be found outside. I'm speaking now of adolescence, when I became aware enough to even take stock of the land. I was afflicted with that malady that plagues most teenagers whenever they grow up, a longing to leave. Anywhere else is better than here. If we lived elsewhere, we would be someone else. Growing up in Clinton, elsewhere, for me, was someplace like Chapel Hill, where you could walk from your dorm to a whole street filled with record shops and restaurants. Elsewhere was urban, or deeply forested and mountainous, or within view of the Atlantic. The inevitable question one gets asked, do you prefer the mountains or the beach, is an either-or query. No one has ever said, do you prefer the mountains, the beach, or Spivey's Corner? So I saw what I felt. And what I felt was mostly boredom. One of the chief entertainments of my youth was for our parents to take us to ride. It was never for a ride, it was always to ride. These trips were focused more on architecture than on agriculture. We would ride out to the Coharie Country Club or the development across the highway called Fox Lake and check out the new construction. Around the time that those rides got old, I started riding around with my friends. These rides were confined to a preordained orbit, established by older siblings and cousins, and as rigidly adhered to as the wagon wheel rutted paths of the Oregon Trail. From the little pep drive-in to the Glamorama laundromat, twice or thrice around Courthouse Square. When we broke the route, it was to drive the 13 miles to Warsaw in neighboring Duplin County, which, unlike Sampson County, sold a malt beverage favored by a certain type of teenager. The ride to Warsaw, we sometimes called it in code, going to Poland, was more of the same tobacco fields and pine forests, but you only noticed it on the way over. In high school, I had a friend, the late Mike Lockamy, who was both ineffably cool and unusually stimulated by the place where we grew up. Mike took me on long rides through the county. We would start up toward Midway or Keener, where the soil is rich and the flat fields plenty, and proceed via back road to the southern end of the county, which might as well be in a different state, so drastically does the ecosystem change. Down there, around Carr Stadium and Ivanhoe, the land turns sandier and swampier as the Black River winds its way down toward the Cape Fear. Pine trees are replaced by fat-trunked bald cypresses, Spanish moss, water moccasins, a river the color of Coca-Cola. It all seemed so exotic. Mike was open to the possibility of what could be seen. He taught me to take pleasure in the off-white afternoon of a cloudy eastern North Carolina Sunday in November, when the fields turned from tawny to the gray of the sky, and showed me that uniformity was magical instead of dreary. I like to think that I would have gotten there myself, but I'm indebted to Mike for taking me at least momentarily out of my adolescent complacency. I don't get down east often. My family moved many, many years ago. But when I do, I see things I never would have thought to notice. The line of pines at the edge of a cornfield seems mysterious to me now, and there are the tobacco barns, which, even back then, seemed to lean with the knowledge of their imminent obsolescence. Chink-logged and tin-roof marbles, wrestled down now by vine and time. To find beauty in a thing you've overlooked is a kind of renewal, but it's also a confirmation. That person you thought you'd be if only you'd grown up in a place more obviously enticing is only a short-sighted version of yourself. All you need, besides a trustworthy guide, is the objectivity of distance and a little emotional maturity to understand that the binary choice of mountains versus beach really should be multiple choice. Mountains, fine. Beach, great. But let's not forget the subtle and bountiful charm of the in-between. And looking back at the pictures, the first picture on this article shows a field of green-yellow tobacco fields. And the caption says, when you drive past the same tobacco field every day, you don't notice it. But time and distance help us see familiar sights through fresh eyes. And the next page. The author, who grew up in Clinton, the seat of Sampson County, the second largest county in the state, was very familiar with the long stretches of flat two-lane blacktop that connected communities like Plainview and Newton Grove and Spivey's Corner. And we have a picture of a small stand of pine trees and with a two-lane road, of course, a flat two-lane road with grass on either side. And in the distance, we see one of the log cabins that was mentioned not a tobacco field, but it looks like a log cabin that someone might have lived in the distance there with a brick fireplace. And the last page shows a picture, I believe, of Bald Cypress. It comes to majesty and beauty. Few things compare to the ancient Bald Cypress trees in the Black River Preserve. And you can see their moss-covered bases that are very wide at the bottom. Don't see a lot of water, per se, but I do see the wide, very wide trunk, wider at the bottom than at the top or midway up. Our last article probably will be entitled, Every Stitch is a Prayer. For 3 years, the Kneeler Girls of Chowan County gathered each week in the parish hall of the historic St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Edenton to stitch symbols of faith into pillows of grace. Debbie Boyle walks along the brick pathway at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Edenton, past the weathered tombstones of some 700 souls, including three former North Carolina governors. Inside the parish hall, about 20 women, all pastels and pearl necklaces, tastefully paired scarves and dresses, and stylish tortoiseshell glasses await her arrival at folding tables. They're hard at work doing needlepoint, their nimble fingers pushing and pulling thread in and out of tiny squares on canvases. Boyle looks around to see if anybody needs her assistance. "Hey, Debbie," one calls out, "will you take a look at this?" Boyle scans the woman's row of stitches and reassures her that it looks good. Almost every Wednesday for 3 years, Boyle and the other women met here promptly at 2 o'clock in the afternoon to stitch new kneeler cushions for the church's altar rail. It was a daunting task, one that Boyle can't believe is finally over. "I don't think it's quite hit me yet," she says, finessing the collar of her white button-down shirt. It's been a few months since the women finished the project, but they've continued to stitch together. The sense of community and friendship that they've found while working on the kneelers has motivated them to keep meeting regularly. The project started in spring 2018 when Martha Blythe and Kathy Busby, co-chairs of the Altar Guild, took inventory of church improvement projects. New kneelers were at the top of their list because the existing ones were more than 40 years old. "They look tired and worn and dull," Boyle says. She has the right to critique the old kneelers. She was part of the team that made them. That's why Blythe and Busby first approached Boyle about creating new ones. Debbie will say we coerced her," Blythe remarks with a laugh. But Boyle immediately agreed, and the women started brainstorming ideas for what the kneelers should look like. There were some non-negotiables. They needed to be a dark color to mask years of use, no piping because it would fray, and most importantly, the kneelers had to reflect the rich history and symbolism of St. Paul's, the second oldest church building in North Carolina. The stained glass window in the chancel, which dates back to the 1850s, served as their blueprint. The red circle in the middle with the monogram IHS, the first three letters of Jesus in Greek, inspired the tops of the kneelers. Each pillow would have a different design: a dove, a shell, a cross and crown, a budded cross, the IHS monogram, the Mosley cup, which is a silver chalice used during special Eucharist feasts, and the Cairo, another Christogram. These symbols would be centered in a dark red circle framed by acanthus leaves. The gussets or sides would be outlined with fleur-de-lis and a grouping of three red circles representing the Trinity. Armed with a box full of yarn and canvases designed and hand-painted by Sheila Ann Osher in Texas, the group, calling themselves the Kneeler Girls, got to work in March 2021. Boylan listed anyone in St. Paul's who was interested in helping, whether they could needlepoint or not. "I wanted as many people working on them as possible," she said, "because it was fun." Each week, the women gathered in the parish hall, laughed, and shared updates on the health of mutual friends as they pulled strands of yarn in and out of a basket weave stitch. People think that when ladies get together, it's a gossip fest. And this wasn't that at all, Sue Willahawk says. Every stitch was a prayer. In the time that it took the women to complete the project, the Kneeler Girls lost a member. Annette Wright's cancer returned, and she died on September 4th, 2023. "She was my best," Boyle says, her voice catching. "My best, you know." The gussets that Wright had stitched were used in the very first finished kneeler, the one with a dove on top. It was a reminder that in her absence, God's peace would mend their heartache. Wright's kneeler was displayed in the middle of the altar rail during her funeral. By November, all seven kneelers were completed. Their royal blue outlines now serve as a beacon, drawing the eye down toward the brick floors of the nave, past the box pews that date to the 1800s, and up to the stained glass that frames the altar. St. Paul's interim rector, the Reverend Dr. Robert Sawyer, held a private service and dedication for the Kneeler Girls and their ecclesiastical works of art. Fittingly, the first knees to be cradled by the new cushions were those of the women who made them. A month later, the kneelers were presented to the entire congregation. The church's reaction was overwhelmingly positive, Blythe says. As congregate kneels before the altar, the stained glass image of Jesus rising from the dead was a reminder to them that God is victorious over every unfair thing in our lives, even the sting of death. "I'm grateful that the Lord grants us his mercy and forgiveness," she says with tears in her eyes. Busby nods in agreement. "It gives me peace," she adds. "And this is the true gift that the kneelers, the women who pulled them together stitch by stitch, have given to all who put themselves at the feet of Jesus at St. Paul's. His grace, as 2 Corinthians makes clear, is sufficient for every day and every hardship, even in closing the book on a five-year labor of divine love." We've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long till next time.